Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Hello, this is Dr. Nurse, and this is our series on the war in Vietnam. And just wanted to remind everybody that we're really looking at personal experience rather than so much of the political aspect of the Vietnam War. Today we're interviewing Don Rudolph. And Don, are you there?
I am. Yeah.
Good, good. I see that you gave me a four-page dissertation on your life, and I really like it. We have a lot in common. I see you worked in a chicken farm, and I've had chicken. And also that you were a go-kart racer, and I crashed many go-karts at the local festivals. Also, it's kind of interesting too. You mentioned about you grew up hunting and fishing, and I had a Red Ryder BB gun, and grew up in Ellensburg, and had a 22. I had to take firearm safety in Ellensburg, and had a 22, and carried that. We were just talking. I carried that around on my bicycle, bungee cord to the handlebars. And can you imagine if a 14-year-old kid is driving a bicycle down the main street with a 22?
I don't think that would go over too well today.
Yeah, different world. And the fact that we even at the high school, we went hunting after I had a 48 Willys Jeep, and we went hunting after high school, and kept shotgun and shells and everything else right in our cars in the parking lot. So, anyhow, so tell me, and also you mentioned that you'd smoked dope with who was that? Jerry Garcia.
I did. Yeah, that was a long time ago.
The closest I came to that was smoking dope while listening to Jerry Garcia. Tell me about a little bit about your, when you were in prior to going to Vietnam, kind of what you were doing and how you got there. You mentioned that, that you enlisted, correct?
No, I was drafted. Definitely was not a volunteer. I guess, a little bit of history. So, I did hunt and fish. My father, unfortunately, died when I was still in high school. And then my mother died a few years later. So where I had been born and raised in the small town Petaluma, California, I kind of unexpectedly uprooted from there. And I ultimately ended up getting a job in Oakland, California. So my older sister lived nearby, and so at Thanksgiving time, 1969, I went to my aunt's house, and she comes out with this little envelope, and here it is, Thanksgiving, and the envelope says, basically, you've been drafted, you need to report on December 3rd. So,
nice Christmas present.
It was quite shocking. I was not prepared for it at all. My family never talked about it. I don't know that my father was involved in the war. I mean, I know they all worked in some capacity during World War II, but unlike some families that have a history going back generations, mine wasn't like that. And I just didn't have really any point of reference for that. So I was very naive, and I wasn't expecting to get drafted. And when I was drafted, it was quite a shock.
And so at that point, then they said, okay, we'll cut your hair and send you to basic training. And mm-hmm. Where did you do the basic training?
Well, this was, I don't know why they sent me to Fort Lewis. And my thinking now is this was December 3rd, and actually officially September 1st, I started the lottery. And, you know, it was like a lottery. You know, if you were the top 200, you were drafted. If not, you got away. So they probably loaded the pipeline. On December 3rd,
are you there? I think I've lost him. We're going to recall if you can hear us. Or what did you think at that point?
Once again, right after, you know, they ask you, I don't know why, but they say, where would you like to go? And I had said, well, Europe sounds like a great place. So in the back of my mind, I thought, well, I'll go through all this training and then I'll get sent to Germany or someplace. So I remember the day when training was complete, and there was probably 300 of us sent out there, and they named about five guys, and they said, all the rest of you are going to Vietnam. And so... that was a shock. And then I thought, well, I'll probably be working in Saigon or an aid station. So that was kind of my thought process, that I wouldn't be in direct combat, but I'd be in more of a support capacity.
And when was that? What time was that?
This was 1970. That got through what they call AIT. It was probably about April. And ultimately, I was shipped to Vietnam right at the beginning of May 1970.
Now, in 1970, were they actually reducing the size of troops because Nixon was in, or were they reducing troops?
It had started, I believe, a very slow withdrawal. I was picked up. I couldn't tell you why. I guess they just needed medics by the 1st Cavalry Division, which was the division that took the most casualties of any Army division. We were in the thick of things just about throughout the whole country. And on May 1st, approximately, Nixon had authorized 2 months what they call an incursion into Cambodia. They sent about, I think, 25,000 of us in there. Against what they thought were about 75,000 NVA troops. And the purpose really was to destroy their encampments and ammunition, trucks, and so forth, which we did.
Were you restricted by the politicians at all, or where you could go, what you could do?
Yeah, we were. Well, not me personally, but overall we were. Yeah, I read where... one of the leaders of one of the other CAV divisions actually had come upon the largest NVA regimental headquarters, you know, in the whole area, and they could have destroyed it, but they were a few miles beyond the 15-mile limit that they set, and so we did not attack them because of that restriction. And so there were a lot of people pretty upset about that.
So did you, when you came to Vietnam... did you come on a regular airliner? Did you come on a boat? Yeah, how did you get there?
Yeah, I was lucky. I know a lot of the Marines went by ship, and thank God I didn't have to do that. It was just the whole land probably. But no, back in by 1970, they were sending us over on a commercial airline. So we stopped to Alaska and Japan, and it was like we were, you know, heading off somewhere nice, air conditioned the whole bit. And of course, once we land there and they open the doors, it's, you know, really hot and humid. Quite a shock to the system.
Yeah, that's one of the questions that I've asked to each of the people I've interviewed. You know, what was your impression when you first landed in Vietnam? And almost to a person, the response has been the heat and the smell, diesel.
Yeah, you know, I kind of like the diesel smell, personally. It didn't bother me, but the heat was shocking. And it took a while to get acclimated to that.
And from there, where did you go once you landed?
Well, once I landed, as I mentioned, the first battery picked me up. They put us through what they called intense jungle training, where we were repelling. I don't know why I remember this, but somebody was showing us how to bite the head off a chicken so they didn't make any noise and all kinds of crazy stuff. And then they flew me on a C-130 up to a place called Song Bay, or it's LZ Buttons, about 15 miles from the Cambodian border. Once I got there, I thought I'd be working in an aid station, but a backpack was filled up, and shortly thereafter, they pointed to a Huey, said, get on that chopper, you're heading for Cambodia. And so about 5 or 10 minutes later, I'm on the ground in Cambodia meeting up with a company of grunts. And ultimately, I was the combat medic for a platoon, so it was about 25 guys, about 4 platoons to a company. And so I took care of 25 guys.
Was there a time when you were out there that you said, gosh, I might not be coming back? I mean, was there a realization, or were you always just hopeful, or how did that transpire?
I think I mentioned, there was a point where it was early on. In fact, the first day over there was general. We thought we heard the enemy and knelt down. I've been in the field for maybe an hour. And finally, kneeling down, my hand was supporting me. I looked down, and my hand was about an inch from a huge tarantula. And so, I guess they're not poisonous, but it, certainly got my attention. And then that evening, we camped out in Triple Canopy Jungle. Well, Triple Canopy allows no light. I mean, zero light. I mean, you could put your hand an inch in front of your face, you can't see a thing.
Wow.
And being a new guy, I almost ended up outside the wire, which is it's a little quick perimeter we put up with Claymore mines. And I darn near found my way out there. I was totally lost. And so that was my first day. I quickly learned. But it's grueling. Yeah, we would go out for 3 weeks at a time looking for the enemy. And we didn't find him. And they'd send the choppers in and whipped us up to another area where we thought the enemy was. And sometimes we'd find other times not. Frequently we'd set up tripwires if we were along a trail, and then at the middle of the night somebody come along and a claymore or hand grenades would explode. Also an AK-47s were firing in, and M-16s were firing out. So it's,
One of the things I was going to ask...
I don't know.
Yeah, one of the things I was going to ask were the... I know what a claymore is, but when you would set them out, kind of in a perimeter, were they activated with a tripwire, or were they, when I've seen claymores go off, they had to be actually activated by someone touching the the two wires together.
Yeah, it's a little clacker, they call it. Yeah, they would hook up with wires, and then there was like a little explosive device that fit in the claymore. And then every night we would take turns. So, it's like 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'd have to get up and sit out there, pulling the device to So the Claymore, if any enemy, came towards us, and then that was usually an hour, and then somebody else would take turns.
And the Claymore was directional too, wasn't it? I mean,
yeah, it actually stands with one end of his face towards enemy. Don't get it wrong.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, you only want it to go one way.
No, that's like C4 embedded with ball bearings, and it literally blows a person's legs off. It's just pretty
well. Tell me a little bit. You mentioned you went out and looking for activity, looking for signs of the enemy. But kind of give me an average day. What time did you get up? What time did you start humping through the forest?
Yeah, it was early. I'd say probably, 5:30, 6 o'clock, I'd get up. We cook. As a medic, every day, every time we stop, basically, I was treating, jungle rot, ringworms. I was giving people malaria pills, any wounds, I was treating them. So that was my job in the morning. Then we'd hump, and we generally go about 5 clicks a day, which, I guess about 5 miles, and through whatever was in front of us. A lot of times you're using machetes, cut your way through. Other times it was, elephant grass or, just conditions are pretty miserable. It was hot in the summer, and then the monsoons came, which was even worse, I think, because, it actually gets cold at night. I remember freezing, soaking wet, and then it'd be my turn for guard duty, and you step out, we'd have what we call a tent house. Each of us carry a tent house, so 2 guys to a tent. And as soon as you step out, you're soaking wet again, and it was rough.
Kind of reminds me of some of those scenes in the movie Platoon, where they're...
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't realize that's a movie, but they're out there in the cold, and,
Yeah, it's actually, that was very realistic, to my experience. So, and some of the biggest things I had to deal with, I guess, were really the element. I was lucky. I didn't have any big battles that lasted days. Most of ours were hit and run, and we did have one episode where we had to come in and take a lot of fire from the tree line, and the group in front of us, they'd killed 3 of the 4 medics, and so we came in, and the guys in front of me actually killed them. It was actually men and women that had been doing the damage, so that was
So you were saying there are women then that were on the NVA.
Definitely, yeah. They could kill just as easy as a guy could, I'll tell you that.
And were you close enough to see them, or were you?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And yeah. That must have been kind of an experience, negative or positive?
I just kept my head down and kept going. I just took it a day at a time, and, it didn't really dwell on anything too much. I was just trying to stay alive, I guess.
Yeah, and I think, again, with many of the veterans that I've talked to, that's what they said. We were just trying to stay alive and go minute for minute and protect the guy on our left and protect the guy on our right. And,
right. Yeah, you get real close to the guys. Again, as a medic, I got to know these guys because I was working on them constantly, morning, noon, and night. And, after a very short time, these are like your brothers, and you just feel like, doing it. And, of course, they all called me Doc, so that kind of put extra pressure where I felt responsible for their well-being.
Yeah. And
other parts of that whole tour for me, which were hard, were the elements themselves. I saw several what are called bamboo vipers. They actually look like a piece of bamboo, but if they bite you, supposedly you're dead within a couple of steps. And then I think I mentioned my note to you. I don't know why I remember. I remember Christmas or Thanksgiving. I remember the 4th of July, 1970. And we were humping along this riverbed. And when we first got to it, it was like the ground was moving. I couldn't figure it out. And it turned out it was all leeches. And the ground was just solid black with leeches. And they were falling out of trees on us the whole day. They were crawling up, dropping down. And then finally, at the end of the day, we got on high road. And some colonel in the back told our captain to send an ambush team down on the river. as a medic, I had to call an ambush team. That was my turn. Thank God the captain kind of argued with the colonel, which is highly unusual, and they let us stay.
You probably didn't go point if you were the medic then, is that correct?
I didn't do what?
You probably didn't be the point man.
No. I remember the point man actually tried to talk me into doing that. And I told him I wasn't really interested in doing that.
Yeah, I wouldn't think that would be the best position to have.
No, that's definitely not a position that you want to have.
One of the veterans I talked to worked with a dog, and
yeah, that would really be something.
And worked with point, being a point man and trying to find activity. And the dog actually attacked him when he didn't put the muzzle on correctly.
Oh, really?
They were not happy dogs, I guess, to
that
say.
Well, after I got out of the jungle, I was on a mountaintop, and we did have a couple of dogs, small dogs up there.
Do you recall when it got close to you getting through with your time there, and you went back probably to some kind of base where they kind of said, here's what's going to happen in the world when you go back?
I don't recall that, having that conversation, no. It was kind of sudden. You know, I was in the, what they called the bush for a few months, and I ended up running a little aid station on a hilltop called Nui Ba Ra, which is in Three Corps, kind of in the middle, about 100 miles north of Saigon, I guess. And it was a radio relay station for the first cab. They also had some G2 intelligence up there that had microphones where they could send artillery shells at certain sites.
And you were still serving as a medic there, and did people come to you?
I'll give shots. It was pretty easy duty there. Other, we'd get, snipers shooting at us periodically, and that was not too cool, but yeah, we had a helicopter crash on the side of the hill, but generally it was pretty easy duty. I mean, I actually had a cot to sleep on and a hot meal, so that was great for me. I was happy with that.
Yeah, you say easier duty. I mean, that's you have to look at both sides. You're comparing that too, maybe easier duty than being out in the bush and being in combat all the time. But I talked to some of these friends of mine from high school who worked on helicopters and were on a base where they were able to sleep in a cot and that kind of thing. And I always asked them, how was your duty? And they used to always say, oh, it's great. We only got mortared every two or three nights,
Exactly.
So, everything in perspective, right?
That's right, yeah. And I didn't know it at the time, but there was another mountain just like in Tainan province. And I know one of the gentlemen that spoke with you was in Tainan, but they were actually overrun and they were all massacred in 1968. So it was probably good I didn't know that.
And where was this?
Attention. That was on Nui Ba Den. That's another radio relay mountain south of where I was.
And how many people would have been there?
I think they killed about 25, 28 soldiers. It was considered a massacre up there. And so I was lucky I didn't happen to be there at that time. So I was on the other mountain, Nui Ba Ra.
Yeah, yeah.
And, it was a big thing up there. Were rats the size of domestic cats and scorpions, and then cobras apparently like eating rats, so we had cobra snakes up there and other things that I don't know what they were, but they were huge. Everything was magnified because of the jungle, I guess.
Cobra filet, I guess is.
I don't know if I'm ever going to cook that or not.
So were you well supplied when you were out in the bush? Did they just bring in, did you have?
It was, if we were lucky, it was once a week. Trapper come in sometimes, with a bladder of water. You know, that was the biggest thing. You know, we had to carry enough water to last us a week, you know, at least 7 days. You know, and then sea rations, which are canned goods, so they're heavy. The pack weighed about 80 pounds, from what I understand. I remember when I first started, I could barely lift it, but after a while, you get used to it, and it's like nothing. But at first, it took two guys to put on the mat.
So you carried, three or four canteens, or?
Yeah, it was like a water bladder, canteen, and then kind of water bladder, probably held a couple of gallons, and then five or six boxes of sea rations, and a tent half, and then I carried an ammo box full of medical supplies, and bandoliers for, stuff like that.
Yeah. Did you pretty much have the... I mean, what was in your medical pack? I assume bandages. I assume
big bandages, morphine. Also, big. We were trained mostly for big wounds, really. It wasn't like going in and doing stitching somebody up. That wasn't our role. Our role is if somebody gets severely injured, to keep them alive long enough to get them on a medevac.
Right. Right. And you mentioned you were on the C-130s, and that was a pretty amazing airplane that could...
I wasn't real crazy about it. I think it's a prop plane, and carried a lot of troops and stuff around. And it's not a quiet ride, I'll tell you that.
I'm sure that's true. When you got out of the field, after you'd been out there 3 weeks, did you then go to a base that was safer and, kind of have a little rest and relaxation, or is there no rest and relaxation in war?
No, there was no R&R. They would, there were bases that were kind of permanent bases, like the LZ buttons at Song Bay, but in the field, they would actually just, if there was a clearing or if there wasn't a clearing, they'd make a clearing for an artillery base out in the middle of nowhere. And so that 1 week we got off, we were filling sandbags and pulling guard duty to support these artillery. And then these artillery shells, of course, they're firing right over our heads. So my hearing's not so great these days, and I blame it on that.
I think that was, I've heard that from a lot of folks. And again, my friend who was a pilot said they created some of the landing areas with dropping out of a C-130, what did they call it? Like a cluster bomb, but it was daisy cutter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he said that would pretty much... wherever it dropped, since it was set off above ground.
Yeah. Yeah, like a 10,000-pound bomb or something like that.
Yeah.
I remember another time of after a B-52 strike, and we'd come on it, and they had actually tore apart some of the bunker, underground bunker. There was a whole community there, and I remember going into the tunnel, and I was really impressed. I mean, these underground bunkers, I wouldn't want to live like that, but the walls are as flat as a wall in a house, out of dirt. But, they did a heck of a job building that underground network.
When you came back to the United States, how were you treated? And where did you come?
I landed at Travis Air Force Base, and since, my folks were gone, the only really person I had was my older sister. And so I caught a bus, and not thinking. I think they probably told us a little bit about, kind of warning us, but, I was just happy to be alive and to be home, so I wouldn't pay much attention, I guess. So I had my Army uniform on. I got on this bus, and all of a sudden, three or four rows of people get up and move. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure it wasn't BO. Well, then this guy comes over and says, I'm a World War II veteran. I'll see you the same. So then all of a sudden went on. It's like, oh, nobody wanted to be seen with a vet. And, of course, a couple on the way, as they're moving back, whispered baby killer and all that stuff to me. So
right.
It was memorable. But, honestly, I was just happy to be alive. I didn't really care what they said. I was just like, hey, whatever. And I just kept on going on.
Yeah. Well, I think that just a lot of people don't. There are certain things that you can't replicate. You can talk about, but it's like seeing the Grand Canyon for the first time. You can see a million pictures of it. Nothing like standing next to it. And I'm sure the same thing is also true with war and how you felt about it. I didn't experience it. I almost felt guilty sometimes that I didn't, but,
You shouldn't. Don't feel guilty about
it.
Feel lucky.
That's right. I agree with you. Well, Don, we're out of time here, but I will let you know when this will air, and you will see your name on there, and you will be the star of BOV, the voice of Vashon.
All right.
I can probably even give you the three or four people that listen to it, so we will see, but we love doing it, and if you ever get back up this way, give me a call.
I will do that, definitely.
Hey, nice talking to you. You take care and have a great day.
You too. Thanks again.
Okay, thanks, John. And that's it. That is it for The Voice of Vashon for this series with Don Rudo.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975, was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.